Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-Roe anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're going to do it together. Let's get unspun. Hi, Truth Seekers, and welcome to Unspun this week. In this week's mini-episode, we'll look at politics season, and in particular, why there are so many stories around polls and debates in national-level news. We'll review the history of televised debates and find out why news organizations sponsor them and cover them in such a frustrating way. Sound good? Let's get unspun.
President Biden, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to this question about the national debt.
He had the largest national debt of any president in a four-year period, number one. Number two, he, that $2 trillion tax cut benefited the very wealthy. What I'm going to do is fix the tax system. For example, we have 1,000 trillionaires in America, billionaires in America. And what's happening? They're in a situation where they, in fact, pay 8.2% in taxes. If they just paid 24%, 25%, either one of those numbers, they'd raise $500 billion, in a 10-year period. We'd be able to wipe out his debt. We'd be able to help make sure that all those things we need to do, child care, elder care, making sure that we continue to strengthen our health care system, making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do dealing with everything we have to do with, look, if we finally beat Medicare.
Thank you, President Biden. President Trump?
Well, he's right. He did beat Medicare. He beat it to death, and he's destroying Medicare because all of these people are coming in. They're putting them on Medicare. They're putting them on Social Security. They're going to destroy Social Security. This man is going to single-handedly destroy Social Security. These
What purpose does something like this serve in the political process? If you just listen to selections like this, you'd think people are interested in seeing a fight. But the politicians are too old for boxing, maybe, so we're stuck with this. For a lot of prospective voters who don't have the interest or time for more than an hour of this, this kind of excerpt is all they're likely to see or hear. And honestly, I find that a little concerning. I talked quite a bit about the history of debates back in episode 10, so if you want the long version, I'd encourage you to go back there. But here are a few highlights as a refresher. Presidential debates are often dubbed the Super Bowl of American democracy, and they draw in millions of viewers. But do they really sway elections? That answer is pretty complex. Debates used to be seen as a chance for serious policy discussion. Nowadays, they've turned into more of a TV spectacle, focusing on personality and catchy sound bites more than on policy. And the shift makes me wonder if debates are actually helpful for voters. Early on, research showed that debates boosted voter knowledge and even engagement, but more recent studies show that fewer people are tuning in, even though debates still seem to influence voter decisions. And this suggests that debates might be more about reinforcing what people already think than about changing their minds. The media coverage after debates often highlights who won or who lost instead of digging into the policy details, and this can kind of amplify this effect. And studies show that when less informed viewers who watch a lot of TV, they're more likely to base their votes on a candidate's look, meaning that style can sometimes overshadow substance. Debates can also help shape how people see lesser-known candidates. Back in 2008, Joe Biden was relatively unknown as a senator from Delaware and running for vice president, and his performance in the 2008 vice presidential debate left a positive impression on viewers who really didn't know very much about him before. And you know, that shows that debates can be informative for some people. However, the debate format with its strict rules and its limited time to answer often gets in the way of deep policy discussions. So this setup encourages candidates to go for memorable zingers and for sound bites. And when you mix that with the media's focus on the spectacle, it's worth asking if these debates actually really benefit the public. So in the end, while debates are a staple in American politics, their impact is complicated. But one of the more interesting aspects of debates that came out recently is the role of the media in sponsoring them, in moderating them, and of course in reporting on them. I need to take a quick break, and when I come back, we'll learn why news media love debates so much. Welcome back. Before we get back into it, I wanted to shout out Greg E. and Stephen P. Both of them have written in to theunspunpodcast@gmail.com with some questions about things from the show. I love hearing from you truth seekers, and I do answer email. Feel free to reach out there or to shoot me a message on X at Dr. Sturge. Okay. Why does the news media focus so much on debates? When you remember that media are businesses, the answer becomes pretty clear. It's money. In fact, all of those political advertisements that you're getting really sick of seeing during an election season, they mean that during election years, the channels that carry election information are making more money than they do in non-election years. It's not just the ads, either. When the media has something to say about elections, that can attract more viewers to their regular programming, too. And more viewers equals more eyeballs that they offer to advertisers, and that equals, guess what? Money. The debate format could be really valuable. It's something of a chance for politicians to talk at length about policy. You know, during a campaign, often journalists have only a small amount of access to the candidates, because the candidates are busy giving their own speeches and traveling from place to place. Sometimes campaigns will pick a few selected friendly outlets to do longer sit-downs, but for most journalists, it's a quick hit after quick hit kind of thing. And so we get debates to kind of even that out a little bit. But let's be honest. When you hear the words political debate, do you get excited? Do you clear your schedule, grab the popcorn, and settle in for a night of riveting political discourse? Or, like a lot of people, do you think, ugh, do I have to? I get it, believe me. While debates have the potential to offer insightful glimpses into candidates' positions and policies, more often than not, they devolve into shouting matches filled with insults, interruptions, carefully crafted sound bites designed to go viral on social media later. And, you know, I'll admit it, I often don't watch, and I find myself just reaching for the transcript after the debate, because I can then digest the information without all the shouting and the sighing and the eye rolling. But why is that? Why have political debates become less about substance and more about spectacle? Well, to understand that, we need to rewind the clock a little bit. Back in the days of Kennedy and Nixon, the first televised presidential debates, the focus was still largely on policy and presentation. Nixon, who was getting over being sick, looked kind of wan and under the weather, and for TV viewers, he lost some ground to the more charismatic Kennedy. Interestingly, the people who had audio only, who listened on the radio, thought Nixon actually did better. So this shows you that visual presentation was starting to matter, but the context of their arguments still held significant weight. Fast forward a few decades to the age of Reagan, who was actually nicknamed the Great Communicator. Ronald Reagan had been an actor, and he understood the power of television, and he mastered the art of delivering catchy sound bites that were quotable and that viewers just loved. He had a famous line from his 1980 debate with Jimmy Carter, "There you go again." And the simple phrase, delivered with Reagan's characteristic charm, allowed him to turn aside criticism and change the subject. See, over time, the definition of winning a debate has shifted. It wasn't enough to have the best thoughts and arguments. Candidates need to be the best performers. They need to create those moments that can be replayed in news stories, kind of etching them into voters' minds. And that brings us to today's media landscape, where information is consumed in bite-sized chunks and attention spans are shorter than ever. Now it's not just about winning the debate, it's about winning the soundbite war. Candidates and their teams spend days crafting those short, punchy statements that are made to be shared, because in the age of Twitter and TikTok, it can change public opinion that way. This focus on spectacle over substance creates a real problem, though, especially for low-information audiences. How are they supposed to make informed decisions when they're seeing much more noise than actual information? It's also a huge challenge for the journalists who moderate these debates. You know, imagine trying to maintain control of a room full of people who are all kind of jockeying for the spotlight and ignoring the rules that they themselves have agreed to beforehand. The most recent U.S. presidential debate at the end of June featured one candidate, Donald Trump, using a manipulation technique that made it really tough for the moderators and for his opponent, Joe Biden, to counter. It's called the Gish Gallop. It involves overwhelming an opponent with as many arguments as possible, without any regard for accuracy or truth or relevance. And the sheer volume of claims makes it practically impossible to address every point thoroughly within that limited amount of time in a debate. And so the galloper looks victorious, and their opponent looks like they just can't keep up. I could give you an example related to the namesake, creationist Dwayne Gish, who used it in verbal contests with evolutionary biologists, but I think it would be more fun to hear a different example.
Johnny Cochran, your closing arguments.
Ladies and gentlemen of the supposed jury, Schaff's attorney would certainly want you to believe that his client wrote Stinky Britches 10 years ago, and they make a good case. Hell, I almost felt pity myself. But ladies and gentlemen of this supposed jury, I have one final thing I want you to consider. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Chewbacca. Chewbacca is a Wookiee from the planet Kishik, but Chewbacca lives on the planet Endor. Now think about that. That does not make sense. Damn it.
What?
He's using the Chewbacca defense. Why would a Wookiee, an 8-foot-tall Wookiee, want to live on Endor with a bunch of 2-foot-tall Ewoks? That does not make sense. But more importantly, you have to ask yourself, what does this have to do with this case? Nothing. Ladies and gentlemen, it has nothing to do with this case. It does not make sense. Look at me. I'm a lawyer defending a major record company, and I'm talking about Chewbacca. Does that make sense? Ladies and gentlemen, I am not making any sense. None of this makes sense. And so you have to remember, when you're in that jury room deliberating and conjugating the Emancipation Proclamation, does it make sense?
That was a clip from the TV show South Park, which illustrates what's been called the Chewbacca defense. It's also a variation of the Gish Gallop, throwing out bits of information that are not true, that are unrelated, or don't matter, but having so many of them that the person you're debating can't possibly answer at all. When the moderators of a debate are journalists, and when those information bits are falsehoods, that presents a real issue. The issue of politicians not being perfectly accurate is pretty well known, as you truth seekers know very well. But prior to 2015 or so, it was uncommon for the rate of inaccuracy to be so great that even journalists can't keep up. Now, CNN's Daniel Dale developed a pretty solid technique of real-time fact-checking when he was covering the White House for the Toronto Star, and other news organizations have gotten better about this as well. Although you should consider that usually the fact checks are displaced in space and or time from the original coverage, so you really do have to go looking for them. So for example, a rally may be carried on television and the real-time fact check is happening on a social network. But still, it's something. With a protracted stream of lies, debate moderators have to choose between calling out falsehoods, which is a journalist's job, or trying to keep the timing and format of the debate to the agreed-on rules, which is the moderator's job. CNN's Dana Bash and Jake Tapper clearly went with the latter, and, to be fair, there was less interrupting and talking over in this debate. The fact checks did happen, with outlets from PolitiFact to the Associated Press to the BBC doing these lengthy day-after stories where they provided a lot of nuances about the truth in what the candidates said. And those stories are important, but again, someone has to go looking for them, and most people won't. Spinach journalism, we used to call it. It's nutritious, but most people don't like it. But what if I told you that media prefer a spectacle to a plate of spinach when it comes to debates? In some ways, this comes back to the topic of news values, those aspects of information that help determine what gets covered and how it gets covered. Conflict is a sure winner of a news value, and people dramatically yelling at each other is a more enticing image of conflict than people calmly discussing minor technical differences on a policy thing. So the idea is that you have the great clip showing the candidate making an outrageous point, and when that clip gets shared, you hope to attract a new audience to your coverage if you're the media. And if the coverage is tawdry enough also, the people might even stick around. But all that tawdry can get in the way of truth. For the candidates, the drama is also a solid strategy when the definition of win a debate is to have the most convincing presence regardless of what you say. You know, as long as you look like a person of conviction, you're a winner in today's model, even if what you're saying is irrelevant or even a lie. And the shareable social media snacks from the debate are going to extend the impact of your performance. So the tally on debates is that these moments benefit two groups, news organizations and politicians. But for those of us in the public, watching live debates doesn't really add much to our understanding about what candidates stand for as much as it does about how straight they stand up. I'll keep reading the transcripts. Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. And find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time, stay sharp, everyone.
Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter,
and grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
Hi, I'm Dan Dunn, the host of What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn, a show that mixes history, culture, politics, famous people, and booze, and strains it through the cognitive mesh of my sozzled gray matter. Join me each week as I take a lighthearted stroll through the consequential role that alcohol has played through the ages, and how it shaped key moments in history, quite literally changing the world. For instance, did you know that Thomas Jefferson started the first U.S. wine company in Virginia with investments from George Washington and Ben Franklin? It's true. And if you're wondering whose winery sits across the street from Jefferson's estate today, here's a hint. What's orange, president, and has a very good brain and the best people. I'll also tell you about new stuff to drink, trends, recipes, and other things that are good to know. And I'll chat up celebrities, along with the movers and shakers of the adult beverage world. And since this is a show about alcohol, I'd like to remind you that drinking can cause memory loss. Or even worse, memory loss. Where was I? Oh, right. Plugging my show. It's called What We're Drinking with Dan Dunn. It's fun, I promise. So come on, pull up a bar stool, and let's kick it.